Hello and welcome to this archive recording of a live-streamed exploring session I produced at the beginning of the plague outbreak in the year of our Cat Lord 2020. Beware the Cat by William Baldwin is a most excellent book, which I have since performed readings of and am currently rehearsing a solo show of. These exploring sessions, five in total, were live-streamed in the afternoon on my personal YouTube channel, because Beyond didn't actually have one at that particular moment, so I am finally archiving it on this stream and creating a Beware the Cat playlist while I'm at it. Beyond some minor cuts, I'm leaving the recordings mostly as recorded, with much of the blah 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 in place. There are errors in my reading and initial thoughts, but that's part of the process. Till next time, I leave you with
Hello and welcome to the Beyond Shakespeare podcast live. I am your host, Robert Crichton. Beware the Cat is really fabulous, and there are some long-winded passages, but they are in character, which I really like. The Master Streamer streams. He's almost a stream of consciousness figure, and again, the readings will start in a moment in the third part of his oration. And he really finds a very long-winded way to say that it's a different time of day. that the sun and the moon move around. I should also like to point out, from a basic scientific basis, that everything he's about to say about the tides and the moon is entirely wrong. I'm assuming that... I don't know whether that's deliberate or not. I'm assuming that they probably knew broadly the connection between the sun and the moon and the moon and the tides. But I genuinely don't know where the science of the day was with this, and whether it's a deliberate thing to make Master Streamer a bit silly, or to present him as a respectable scientist. Because of course, in the previous episodes, certainly last episode, don't try this at home. He came up with a magical potion, which he read in a book, so that he could listen to the cats that were outside of his window. And so the entire book is being told by Master Streamer to his friends in their lodgings one night. So he will talk in a moment, mention Master Willett, who's listening. Who's an astronomer in the court. Usual trigger warnings. It's a bit grim. There's shall we say, some animal cruelty coming up. Also that this is not an ecumenical matter. This is, again, very anti-Catholic, and the anti-Catholic element really comes to the fore here. So this text was started in some fashion around 1552-53 during the reign of Edward VI. It is then shelved when Mary, a Catholic monarch, comes to the throne of England. And there is a sense that the author here is trying to get across they felt persecuted, and the back and forth between Protestantism and Catholicism. Also that putting forth now, at the time this was published in a Protestant time, that the author believes you cannot trust Catholics, that they are constantly there in a corner listening to what you're saying, reporting on you, doing strange ceremonies, believing in dangerous magic. There's another callback as well, which is almost perfectly timed. It's not quite. Because this third part, one of the narratives told by the various cats, you're going to hear a lot of cats talking today. I'm going to endeavour to make sure you can tell the difference between the narrator's voice then the narrator's telling stories within the narration. It's all overlappy, inny-outy, timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly. This story feeds directly on quite an old story. It's quite a popular story, obviously, because this is the third version explicitly repurposed version of Dame Cirith, a story of a wise woman who is wise, who might be is not a witch per se, but is certainly full of cunning and takes on jobs to hoodwink people. And in this particular instance, she acts as a pander and persuades a woman to give in to the ministrations of a man. And you know, this story is several hundred years old at this point when this Beware the Cat is written. And there is always a problem. I performed Dame Cirith as a storytelling piece, and we're about to release an edited play version of the story, because Dame Cirith is really a play. It's a sort of narrative play. It is written out as a script. And so it's that sort of between storytelling and theatre world. But there is a slight problem, especially for a modern audience, but even for the audience then, that there is a serious consent issue that the narrative brings up, and that we're supposed to somehow play along and have fun with it. And that's an interesting balancing act to have when trying to perform that today. And Beware the Cat clearly has the same problem with the original story, because Beware the Cat changes it somewhat. And it solves one of the problems with the story, by which it makes the protagonists connected with this sinister world of these cats and the paranoid Catholic underground that the writer is against, and so it means that you're no longer feeling like you have to feel sympathy and feel on the side of this dame figure who turns up. And obviously, because it's Beware the Cat, whereas in Dame Cirith the narrative orbits around a dog, in this it is transposed directly to a cat. But the story of trying to figure out a way of hoodwinking a married woman into sleeping with a young man is exactly the same. And hopefully very soon you'll be able to do a proper compare and contrast with this and Dame Cirith. There is on the podcast a very short fragmentary interlude, Interludium de Clerico et Puella, or the interlude of the clerk and the girl, student and the girl, which is exactly the is another version of Dame Cirith. It's a later version, even more of a play version of the story. So there is a lineage to this tale, and I think it's really well repurposed. Of course, it's still problematic because, of course, we live in an age where we like to be fair to people and don't like to persecute them because of their religion. And so it still has we have a sort of shifted awkwardness to where we object to what this narrative is doing. That doesn't mean to say that it isn't a really interesting story, and I am now going to attempt to perform it. We're going to get about two-thirds of the way through this third part of Master Streamer's oration. By this time, waning Cynthia, which the day before had filled her growing horns, was come up on our hemisphere, and freshly yielded forth her brother's light, which the reverberation of Thetis' trembling face, now full by means of spring, had fully cast upon her, whereof she must needs lose every day more and more, by means that the neap abasing Thetis' swollen face would make her to cast beyond her those rads which before the full the spring had caused her to throw short, like as with a crystal glass. A man may by the placing of it either high or low so cast the sun or a candle-light upon any round glass of water that it shall make the light thereof both in wearing and waning to counterfeit the moon. For, as you shall understand, chiefly you, Master Willett, that are my lord's astronomer, that all our ancestors have failed in knowledge of natural causes, for it is not the moon that causeth the sea to ebb and flow, neither to neap and spring, but the neaping and springing of the sea is caused of the moon's both waxing and waning. For the moonlight is nothing save the shining of the sun cast into the element by opposition of the sea, as also the stars are nothing else but the light reflected upon the face of rivers and cast upon the crystalline heaven, which, because rivers always keep like course, therefore are the stars always of one bigness. As for the course of the stars from east to west is natural by means of the sun's like moving, but in that they ascend and descend, that is, sometime come northward and sometime go southward, that is caused also by the sun's being either on this side or on the other side, this line, like nautical. The like reason followeth for the poles not moving, and that is the situation of chose rivers or dead seas which cast them, and the roundness of its form of the firmament. But let this pass, which in my book of Heaven and Hell shall be plainly not only declared, but both by reason and experience proved, I will come again to my matter. When Cynthia, I say, following her brother's steps, had looked in at my chamber window, and saw me neither in my bed nor at my book, she hied her apace into the south, and at a little hole in the house roof peeped in, and saw me where I was set to hearken to the cats. And by this time all the cats which were there the night before were assembled with many other, only the great grey one excepted, unto whom, as soon as he was come, all the rest did their beance as they did the night before. And when he was set, thus he began in his language, which I understood as well as if he had spoken English. "Ah, my dear friends and fellows, you may say I have been a lingerer this night, and that I have tarried long, but you must pardon me, for I could come no sooner. For when this evening I went into an ambry, there was much good meat to steal my supper. There came a wench, not thinking I had been there, and clapped the lid down, by means whereof I have had much to do to get forth. Also, in the way as I came hither over the housetops, in a gutter were thieves breaking in at a window, who frayed me so, that I lost my way and fell down into the street, and had much to do to escape the dogs. But seeing that, by the grace of Haggart and Hegg, I am now come, although, as I perceive by the tail of the great bear and by Alhabor, which are now somewhat southward, that the fifth hour of our night approacheth, yet seeing this is the last night of my charge, and that tomorrow I must again to my lord Camoloch. At this, all the cats spread their long tails and cried, "Haggart and Hegg, save him! Now go to, good mouse-slayer," quote he, "and that in time which my misfortune hath lost, recover again by briefness of thy talk."
"I will, my lord," quoth Mouse Slayer, which is the cat which I told you stood before the great cat the night before, continually mewing, who in her language after ye with her tail she made curtsy, shrunk in her neck, and said, "Whereas, by virtue of your commission from my lord Camoloch, whose life Haggart and Hegg defend, who by inheritance and by our free election enjoyeth the empire of his traitorously murthered mother, the god's Grimmolochin, you his griffer and chief counsellor, my lord Grisard, with Isagrim and Poilnor, your assistants, upon a complaint put up in your hides by that false accuser, Catch-Rat, who beareth me malice because I refused his lecherously offered delights, have caused me in purging myself before this honourable company to declare my whole life since the blind days of my kitlinghood. You remember, I trust, how in the two nights past I have declared my life for 2 years' space, wherein you perceive how I behaved me all that time. Wherefore, to begin where I left last, you shall understand that my lord and lady, whose lives I declared unto you last yesternight, left the city and went to dwell in the country, and carried me with them. And being there strange, I lost their house, and with bird hunt my make, the gentlest in honest venery that ever I met with, went to a town where he dwelt called Stratford, either Stony upon Tyne or upon Avon, I do not well remember which, where I dwelt half a year. And this was in the time when preachers have leave to speak against the mass, but it was not forbidden till half a year after. In this time I saw nothing worthy to certify my lord of save this. My dame, with whom I dwelt, and her husband were both old, and therefore hard to be turned from their rooty belief, which they had in the mass, which caused divers young folk, chiefly their sons and a learned kinsman of theirs, to be the more earnest to teach and persuade them. And when they had most brought the matter to a good point, I cannot tell how it chanced. But my dame's sight failed her, and she was so sick that she kept her bed 2 days. Wherefore she sent for the parish priest, her old ghostly father, and when all were voided, the chamber save I and they too, she told him how sick she was and how blind, so that she could see nothing, and desired him to pray for her and give her good counsel. To whom he said thus, "It is no marvel, though you be sick and blind in body, which you suffer your souls willingly to be blinded. You send for me now. But why send you not for me when these new heretics teach you to leave the Catholic belief of Christ's flesh in the sacrament?"
"Why, sir," quoth she, "I did send for you once, and when you came they posed you so with holy writ and saints' writing that you could say nothing but call them heretics, and that they had made the New Testament themselves."
"Yea," quoth he, "but did not I bid you take heed then, and told you how God would plague you?"
"Yes, good sir," quoth she, "you did, and now to my pain I find you too true a prophet, but I beseech you for to give me, and I beseech you forgive me, and pray to God for me, and whatsoever you will teach me, yea, will I believe unto death."
"Well," quoth he, "God refuseth no sinners that will repent, and therefore in any case believe ye Christ's flesh, body, soul, and bone is as it was born of our Blessed Lady in the consecrated host, and see that therefore you worship it, pray and offer to it. For by it any of your friends' souls may be brought out of purgatory, which these new heretics say is no place at all, but when their souls fry in it, they shall tell me another tale. And ye, you know, may know all ye that is true, and that the mass can deliver such as trust in it from all manner of sins. I will by and by say you a mass that shall restore your sight and health."
Then took he out of his bosom a wafer cake and called for wine, and then, shutting the door unto him, revised himself in a surplice, and upon a table set before the bed, he laid his portus, and thereout he said mass. And when he came to the levitation, he lifted up the cake and said to my dame, which in 2 days afore saw nothing,
"Wipe thine eyes, thou sinful woman, and look upon thy Maker."
With that she lifted up herself and saw the cake, and had her sight and her health as well as ever she had before. When Mass was done, she thanked God and him exceedingly, and he gave her charge that she should tell to no young folks how she was holp, for his bishop had throughout the diocese forbidden them to say or sing any Mass, but commanded her that secretly unto old honest men and women she should at all times most devoutly rehearse it. And by reason of this miracle, many are so confirmed in the belief that although by a common law all masses upon penalty were since forbidden, divers have them privily and nightly said in their chambers until this day.
Marry, sir, quoth Polynor, this was either a mighty miracle or else a mischievous subtlety of a majestical minister. But sure, if the priest by magical art blinded her not afore, and so by like massical sorcery cured her again, it were good for us to hire him or other priests at our delivery to sing a Mass before our kitlings. Yea, they might in their birth be delivered of their blindness, and sure, if I knew that priest, it should scape me hard, but I should have one litter of kitlings in some chamber where he useth now to say his prithee night masses.
What need ye? Quoth Mouselier. It would do them no good, for I myself, upon like consideration, kitnied since in an other mistress's chamber of mine, where a priest every day said Mass, but my kitlings saw not ye better, but rather ye worse. But when I heard ye, the Lord with whom I went into the country would to London, then to dwell again, I kept the house so well for a month before that when my lady, when she went, carried me with her. And when I was come to London again, I went in visitation to mine old acquaintance. And when I was great with kitling, because I would not be unpurveyed of a place to kitten in, I got in favour and household with an old gentlewoman, a widow, with whom I passed out this whole year. This woman got her living by boarding young gentlemen, for whom she kept always fair wenches in store, for whose sake she had the more resort. And to tell you the truth of her trade, it was fine and crafty and not so dangerous as deceitful. For when she had soaked from young gentlemen all that they had, then would she cast them off, except they felt a cheating. Wherefore many of them in the night time would go abroad and bring the next morning home with them sometimes money, sometimes jewels, rings or chains, sometimes apparel, and sometimes they would come again cursing their ill fortune, with nothing save peradventure dry blows or wet wounds. But whatsoever they brought, my dame would take it, and find the means either so to gauge it, she would never fetch it again, or else melt it and sell it to the goldsmiths. And notwithstanding that she used these wicked practices, yet she was very holy and religious, and therefore, although that all images were forbidden, yet she kept one of Our Lady in her coffer, and every night, when everybody were gone to bed and none in her chamber but she and I, then she would fetch her out and set her upon her cupboard, and light up two or three wax candles before her, and then kneel down to her, sometimes an whole hour, saying over her beds, and praying her to be good unto her, and save her, and all her guests, both from danger and shame, and promising that then she would honour and serve her during all her life. While I was with this woman, I was always much cherished and made of. For on nights while she was praying, I would be playing with her beds, and always catch them as she let them fall, and would sometime put my head in the compass of them and run away with them about my neck, whereas many times she took pleasure, yea, and so did Our Lady too. For my dame would say sometimes to her, "Yea, blessed lady, I know thou hearest me by thy smiling at my cat." And thus did my dame do me any hurt, save once, and that I was even with her for, and ye was thus. There was a gentleman, one of her boarders, much enamoured in the beauty of a merchantman's wife in the city, whom he could by no means persuade to satisfy his lust. Yea, when he made her great banquets, offered her rich apparel and all kind of jewels precious, which commonly women delight in, yea, and large sums of money which corrupt even the gods themselves, yet could he by no means alter her mind, so much she esteemed her good name and honesty. Therefore, forced through desire of that which he could not but long for, and so much the more because he was most earnestly denied him, he brake his mind to my dame, and entreated her to aid him to win this young woman's favour, and promised her for a labour whatsoever she would require. Whereupon my dame, which was taken for as honest a woman as any in the city, found the mean to desire this young woman to a dinner, and again she should come. My dame gave me a piece of pudding which she had filled full of mustard, which as soon as I had eaten, wrought so in my head that it made mine eyes run all the day after, and to mend this she blew pepper in my nose to make me sneeze. And when the young wife was come, after that my dame had showed her all the commodities of her house, for women delight to shew forth what they have, they set them down together at the table, none save only they two, and while they were in gossips talk about the behaviours of this woman, and that I came, as I was accustomed, and sat by my dame. And when the young woman, hearing me cough and seeing me weep continually, asked what I ailed, my dame, who had tears at her commandment, sighed, and fallen as if it were in a sudden dump, brast forth in weeping and said, "In faith, mistress, I think I am the infortunatest woman alive, upon whom God hath at once poured forth all his plagues. For my husband, the honestest man that lived, he hath taken from me, and with him mine heir and only son, the most cowardly young man that was alive. And yet not satisfied herewith, lo, here mine only daughter, which, though I say it was as fair a woman and as fortunately married as any in this city, he hath, for here cruel honesty or cruelty I cannot tell whether, turned her into this likeness, wherein she hath been above these 2 months, continually weeping as you see and lamenting her miserable wretchedness." The young woman, astonished at this tale, and crediting it by means of my dame's lachrymable protestations and deep dissimulation, asked her the more earnestly how, and by what chance, and for what cause, as she thought she was so altered. Crowed my dame, "As I said before, I cannot tell what I should think, whether excuse my daughter and accuse God, or else blame her and acquit him, for this my daughter being, as I said, fortunately married, and so beloved of her husband, and loving him again too, as now we both too late do, and ever I shall,
think shall rue, was loved exceedingly of another young man, who made great suit and labour unto her. But she, as I think all women should, esteeming her honesty and promise made unto her husband the day of their marriage, refused still this desire. But because he was importunate, she came at the last and told me it, and I, thinking that I had done well, charged her in any case, which full oft since I have repented, that she should not consent unto him, but to shake him off with shrewd words and threatening answers. She did so, alas, alas, the while, and the young man, seeing none other boot, went home and fell sick, and loving so honestly and secretly that he would make none other of his counsel, for pined and languished upon his bed the space of 3 days, receiving neither meat nor drink, and then perceiving his death to approach, he wrote a letter, which I have him in my purse, and sent it to his boy, to my daughter. If you can read, you shall see it. I cannot, but my daughter here could very well and write.
Here with my dame wept apace, and took the letter and gave it this young woman, who read it in form following: The nameless lover to the nameless beloved, in whose love sinneth he may not live, he desireth license to die. Cursed be the woeful time wherein mutual love first mixed the mass sea of my miserable carcass. Cursed be the hour that ever the fatal destinies that ought for me pervade. Yea, cursed be the unhappy hour, may I say, in which I first saw those piercing eyes, which by insensible and unquenchable power, inflaming my heart to desire, are so blind of all mercy, as will rather with rigour consume my life. Then rue my grief with one drop of pity. I sue not to you, my dear unloving love, for any kind of grace, the doubtful hope whereof despair hath long since, with the pouring showers of cruel words, utterly quenched. But this much I desire, which also by right me thinketh my faithful love hath well deserved, that sith your fidelity in wedlock, which I can and must needs praise, as would to God I could not, will suffer my course no longer to retain the breath through cold cares wholly consumed, yet at the last, which is an office of friendship before God's meritorious, come visit him who would if aught might quench love and should not love, whose mouth these 3 days have taken no food, whose eyes the like time have taken no rest, whose heart these 3 weeks was never merry, whose mind these 3 months was never quiet, whose bed these 7 nights was never made, and who, to be brief, is in all partisimo enfeebled, that living he dieth, and dead awhile he liveth. And when this silly ghost shall leave this cruel and miserable prison in recompense of his love, life, and death, let those white, tender hands of yours close up those open windows through which the uncomfortable light of your beauty shone first into his heart. If you refuse to do this, I beseech the gods immortal, to whom immediately I go, that as without any kind of either love or kindness you have caused me to die, so that none other caught with your beauty do likewise perish, I beseech, I say, the just gods, that either they change that honest stony heart, or else disfigure that fair, merciless favour. Thus, for want of force, either to indite or write any more, I take my leave, desiring you either to come and see me die, or if I be dead before, to see me honestly buried. Yours, unregarded alive, G.S. When the young woman had read this letter, she took it again to my dame, and with much to withhold her swelling tears, she said, I am sorry for your heaviness, much more for this man's, but most for your daughter's. But what did she after she saw this letter? Ah, quoth my dame, she is deemed it, as she did his suits before she sent him, a rough answer in writing. But ere ever the boy came home with it, his master was dead. Within 2 days after my son-in-law, her husband died suddenly, and within 2 days after, as she sat here with me lamenting his death, a voice cried aloud, "Ah, flinty heart, repent thy cruelty." And immediately, oh, extreme rigor, she was changed as you now see her. Whereupon I gather that though God would have us keep our faith to our husbands, yet rather than any other should die for our sakes, we should not make any conscience to save their lives. For it fareth in this point as it doth all other, for as all extremities are vices, so it is a vice, as appeareth plainly by the punishment of my daughter, to be extreme in honesty, chastity, or any other kind of virtue. This, with the talk of my dame in the dinner time, so sank it to the young woman's mind that the same afternoon she sent for the gentleman whom she had erst so constantly refused, and promised him, yea, if he would appoint her any unsuspected place, she would be glad to meet him, to fulfil all his lust, which he appointed to be the next day at my dame's house, where when they were all assembled, I, minding to acquit my dame for giving me mustard, caught a mouse, whereof my dame always was exceeding afraid, and came with it under her clothes, and there let it go, which immediately cropped up upon her leg. Oof, but Lord, how she bestirred us then, how she cried out, and how pale she looked, and I, to amend the matter, making as though I leapt at the mouse, all to bescrat her thigh and her belly, so that I dare say she was not whole again in 2 months after. And when the young woman to whom she showed her ponced thigh said, I was an unnatural daughter to deal so with my mother. Nay, quoth she, I cannot blame her, for it was through my counsel that she suffered this sorrow, and yet I dare say she did it against her will, thinking to have caught the mouse, which else, I dare say, would have crept into my belly. By this means was this innocent woman, otherwise invincible, brought to commit whoredom. And thus ends this episode of Beware the Cat. More stories to follow tomorrow as we conclude the narrative of the talking cats. It is interesting, I say, that this following on from Dame Cerith solves so many issues to some degree. It still manages to tell a moderately unpleasant story. It is a little sharper in its misogyny, I do feel. The text is a little it does step over that line a bit. There's an awful lot of this kind of sort of Top Gear quality banter throughout a lot of plays and writing from this sort of period, and I do wonder whether it dips out a little bit once Elizabeth comes to the throne. It just seems like maybe it's something coming from an earlier time, and it shifts and changes. I'm thinking out loud here because I genuinely don't know, but it's just the way it connects with some of the plays we've done from slightly earlier, where that it is a little unpleasant in places, and is generally there are little asides and little throwaway lines that are just constantly picking and suggesting that that women are as suspicious and dangerous as this particular text says. Catholics, again, modern times, we don't have such an opinion. We are placing this text in its historical context. And that most of the cats themselves are women as well. So there is that creeping in there, especially in that final image of the mouse going up the dame's legs, and the cat then
climbing up, scratching her thighs and her belly, which suggests that it's very much under the skirts and going very much for the intimate areas, and is quite aggressive. I just wanted to end briefly with a few little bits and bobs from Dame Cerith, from the earliest version of this that we have, or that I know of that we have, which was a few hundred years earlier. And the Dame is very similar. In Dame Cerith, she doesn't run a bawdy house, which seems to be what the suggestion here. There doesn't seem to be any of that, and she makes much more of a sense of being just a wise person who's definitely putting forward being a good Christian woman. You know, maybe not a good Christian woman, but it's a lot more there. But I just wanted to just read briefly Dame Cerith's protestations, her story about what happened to her daughter. It's a much more condensed version than the narrative here. And obviously in the original tale, it's a dog rather than a cat. Oh, so she's lamenting to the her mark, as it were, the young wife. Oh, I had a daughter fair and free, fairer nee might no man see. She had a courteous husband, freer man might no man fand. My daughter loved him all too well, forth he make I sorry dell. Upon a day he was out wend, and there through was my daughter shend. He, head on errand out of town, and come a Modi clerk with crown, to my daughter his love bead, and she would not follow his reed. He nay might his will have, for nothing he might crave. Then began the clerk to witch, and shaped my daughter to a bitch. This is my daughter that I of speak, for dell of mine heart breaketh. Look how her eye greeten, on her cheeken, the tears meeten. Forthy dame, it were no wonder that mine heart burst asunder, and whosoever is young housewife, she loveth full little her life, and any clerk of her love bead, but she grant and let him speed. So, sort of variations there. I may be overstating the difference in the nature of the underlying misogyny that exists in this story throughout its life. They aren't really about giving women any kind of agency, really, except to be a bit immoral. But thoughts, please, on that. There will be more material. The Dame Cerith has been recorded. I haven't edited it yet, but I have done a cast recording of that. It's a semi-modernized text, but I've tried to keep it as close to the original, and it is quite old, so it is a tricksy bit to try and get the best of both worlds. And say the Interludium de Clerico et Puella, which does the very opening of the narrative, the young man going to the married woman, and then him having been rebuffed, going to the dame or the mother in that particular variation, and they are very similar. And this is a very much a total reworking. There's a lot more detail. There's a lot more back and forth. But it is very clearly the same story, retold hundreds of years later. And of course, there's always the possibility to do that with any story. Thank you very much for listening. Have a lovely day, and hopefully you'll hear me tomorrow for the final part of Beware the Cat. Have a lovely day.
And that was my plague year exploration of Beware the Cat by William Baldwin. Didn't I sound so young? If you'd like to hear more from this text, you're in luck, as not only are there a host of readings and discussions around this text, but I'm also working on a solo production right now. If you'd like it to come to your area of the United Kingdom, there's a link in the show description about how to get in touch. You'll also find there are links to all the audio recordings and discussions of the text available now. And if you like generally what we do, support our work at patreon.com/beyondshakespeare, or you can throw us a one-off bonus at ko-fi.com/beyondshakespeare. Goodbye.